Today is Monday, June 26. We're going to be working more on the respiratory system today.
So last Wednesday, we talked about the pathway of air into the respiratory system. We started with the nose, passed through nasal turbinates. We passed then down to three regions of the larynx. And then finally, we passed into the lower respiratory system, starting with the trachea. So thinking about the upper respiratory system that includes the nose, the nasal turbinates, those regions of the pharynx, what are some parts of those systems that help to keep debris and dust, bacteria, out of your lower respiratory pathways? What's in their cilia? Good. What else is in that nasal cavity?
Tonsils.
Good. That's another one. Mucus. Good. Good. So we've got mucus that can help trap bacteria and debris. We've got tiny, tiny little extensions of your plasma membrane known as cilia. And then great tonsils also help to trap and destroy things like incoming bacteria and viruses. In what direction do the cilia in your nasal cavity sweep contaminated mucus? Back. Good. Once you pass into the lower respiratory, like we're looking at here, this mucus is being swept in what direction? Up, yeah. So the goal is to make sure that the mucus meets at your mouth. That way you either have the option of coughing it out, swallowing it, spitting it out, whatever the choice is, and that keeps it out of these lower respiratory passageways. The fact that we get tinier and tinier passageways means that we have less room for cilia. So once you reach the very smallest passageways, known as bronchioles, we actually no longer have cilia lining those passageways. Cannot get that word out today. So what do we have there instead of cilia to help destroy stuff? Macrophages, good. And what do macrophages do for a living? Eat, good. So when we get to those really small branching bronchioles, we now have macrophages, and of course in the alveoli, we're looking at macrophages as well. So that kind of takes us on a tour of the flow of air. We're going to hit that again as we get to page 72, but we're going to look at that as one of our tracings for test number 3. So we focus so much on getting the air into the lungs, we've kind of forgotten about the lungs themselves. We'll talk about them more as organs in just a moment. I'd like to take you to our final destination, which is the alveolar air sacs that surround those branching bronchioles. So our bronchioles are very small. They're about 1 millimeter in diameter, and they're so small that they lose their rings of cartilage as well as the cilia lining their insides. So when we get to this point, we have such thin walls that we're now in what's called a respiratory zone. We can now perform gas exchanges. So this takes us to the top of page 70. Let's talk about those alveoli there. You know, to give you a kind of a mental idea of how thin-walled these alveoli are, they're as thin-walled as a soap bubble. So that's incredibly thin, easy for gas exchange to take place, and we're allowing for gases to move across simply by diffusion. So I'd like to focus on this picture for just a moment. What gas are we trying to move into our bloodstream?
Oxygen.
Good. And move out of the bloodstream?
Carbon
dioxide or CO2. And you can see in these pictures that these pulmonary capillaries wrap closely around the alveolar air sacs, and in between there is simply a layer of membrane called a basement membrane right there. So all those gases have to do is diffuse across basically three layers of tissue. That's it. So it's easy for us to have, say, a diffusion rate from high to low concentration either into or out of that bloodstream. I did want to show you this picture that our alveoli account for about the surface area of a football field. That's a tremendous amount of tissue that we have packed into our lungs for diffusion to take place. So if you have lung damage and you lose surface area, it just kind of screams how important that surface area is for exchanging gases. Something else I wanted to show you in one of these pictures, probably this way, there we go, is a layer of an oily fluid here that lines the inside of your alveoli, and it's called surfactant. So surfactant is kind of like Pam cooking spray. If you cook at home and you use some type of cooking spray, what is it preventing from happening?
Sticking.
Sticking, exactly. So what is surfactant preventing from happening? sticking, yeah. What sticking to what? Alveoli sticking to alveoli. Yeah, so you actually don't want your alveoli sticking together. Let me take you way back into Bio 210. In Bio 210, we probably talked about water, and we talked about the fact that water likes to make hydrogen bonds. You may recall that hydrogen bonds are weak attractions between neighboring water molecules. So that drives this functional characteristic of water that we called cohesion. So water likes to stick to water molecules. You do have a lot of water molecules lining the inside of your alveoli. They do like to stick together. And of course, when they do, they'll form hydrogen bonds, and that tissue will stick, and our lung tissue will collapse. So this surfactant, this oily secretion, is going to line the inside of your alveoli, and that prevents your lung tissue from sticking and making your lungs collapse. So when a mom is pregnant and premature babies are born earlier than around 38 weeks, babies don't yet make enough surfactant, so their lungs collapse. They intubate the preemies, they put in a surfactant-type spray, and they wait until the baby matures into a certain age, and then that surfactant spray no longer is needed, and the baby makes his or her own surfactant and keeps those lungs inflated. So it's around 38 weeks or so that we start making our own surfactant. They're not really entirely sure why babies are born when they're born. You know, there's certainly a time when we expect them to be born around 40 weeks of gestation, but they think it may have something to do with the presence of surfactant in the baby's lungs. That may be what stimulates the whole birthing process and makes women go into labor. So it would be interesting to know if that is a driving factor because, hey, you know, babies born without surfactant ultimately could die without having those lungs inflated. So a really important set of oily secretions. There are cells embedded within the walls of the alveoli that make surfactant. So that's, again, why we consider the tissue in our alveoli to be a tissue and not just a set of cells. It is simple squamous epithelium that makes up the alveoli, but there's also the surfactant-secreting cells embedded there as well. Okay, so I think we've hit the info up there on the top of page 70 about your alveoli. Do you have any questions so far? So how would you describe lung tissue? Hard and strong, stretchy and soft? Stretchy, yeah, definitely stretchy. It is an elastic type of tissue, and we know all about elasticity. It's not just the ability to stretch, it's the ability to recoil. Yeah, so that's the catch about lung tissue, is you want very strong but stretchy tissue, want it to stretch due to the elasticity, but you also need the recoilability upon contraction of the intercostal muscles, or relaxation rather, of those intercostal muscles. Let's see, we've got an apex or a pointed region that sticks up toward our clavicles. Where do you find the base of each lung? Yep, sitting down here on top of the diaphragm. Okay, and each lung has a set of lobes. Which lung has three lobes?
Right.
Right, good. And of course, the left only has two lobes. What makes the difference there?
The heart,
good. So I hope you've seen this in lab. Have you got a chance to look at the cat lungs yet? Okay, I think that's really cool to be able to see a real set of lungs. They are, in fact, separate lobes. You can pull up each individual lobe and look at it as a separate entity from the others. And so when your lungs inflate, each of those lobes is a separate piece from the others and will inflate separately as well. So they can remove a continuous lung lobe, and of course the others will still manage to inflate if need be.
Sorry.
It's okay. So I'd like to talk about the pleura. I know you've heard of pleura before in Bio 210. What type of membrane makes up your pleura?
Serous.
Good, good. Thinking way back, you may recall that these membranes are two layers thick. There's an outer parietal membrane and an inner visceral membrane. What's between the two layers? serous fluid, good. And the function of that fluid?
Friction.
Good, reduce friction. So I like to think of it as a lubricant. It helps those layers to glide and slide past each other. So when you're breathing, the lungs don't actually rub against the thoracic cavity wall. So we do have serous fluid between the two layers. It is secreted by both visceral and parietal pleura. We don't often think about why these are such important membranes. They're actually what helps our lungs to inflate when you expand your thoracic cavity, and they're also what helps your lungs to deflate because they're kind of part of the thoracic cavity wall. So which of these two layers is in fact anchored to your thorax wall?
Parietal.
Parietal, good. And in fact, your heart should be situated in between. That parietal pleura is anchored to the outermost layer that surrounds your heart. And this is digging back into the previous set of material. What was the very outermost layer around your heart called? Fibrous, yeah. So in fact, parietal pleura is anchored to your fibrous pericardium. So they're all like kind of a glued together outer sac. When we talk about our lung cavity, we're actually talking about the space between our parietal and visceral pleura, and that creates a cavity in which the lungs reside in each of our thoracic cavity portions. So I do want to mention, because we kind of dance all around this but don't really nail it on the head, there are two sets of muscles, not of course in the lungs or inside the thoracic cavity, but that make up the wall of your thorax that are important for breathing. So very bottom of your page, the diaphragm and external intercostal muscles are important muscles to help us breathe. So in this previous picture here, we can see the diaphragm. It is a dome-shaped muscle that sits on the under the base of your lungs. So where do you find the external and internal intercostal muscles?
Ribs,
right. So one set sits angled in one direction, the other set sits angled in an opposite direction. So when they contract, they either expand your rib cage out or they allow for the relaxation of your rib cage and the return to its normal size. So that's really what we're looking at, two primary sets of muscles that are involved in breathing. So that's kind of it for the anatomy overview. How about questions on any of the parts we've covered today or last Wednesday? So I'd like to take you on a tour of respiratory disorders. They are found on page 71, and I'd like to break them down, first of all, by what they primarily influence. So you have a set of disorders that affect the pleura on the outside of the lungs. We think of these as pleurisy, pneumothorax, and pleural effusion. And then we have a set of disorders that affect the passageways. Oh, I got the word out that time. It didn't jinx me that time. Passageways. So we've got obstructive disorders and restrictive disorders. And I know in lab you guys have talked about these, right? So obstructive disorders prevent you from breathing out or in?
Out.
Out, right. So O for O, obstructive prevents exhalation of air, breathing out, O for O. And restrictive disorders prevent you from breathing air in. So they prevent inhalation. So you probably noticed this, but the three P words up here, pleurisy, pneumothorax, pleural effusion, all affect the pleura, so that might be an easy way to keep those straight. Just checking to see if anybody still needs this slide. Okay. good. Anybody else? Okay. Anybody ever had pleurisy? So this is a rather painful disease. You know, anytime you've had something like pneumonia that does not go away, we oftentimes go back and say, hey, I've still got this pain when I breathe. I got an awful cough. And they may prescribe for you another round of antibiotics. So, you know, pneumonia can be a rather tough thing to kick. If you continue to have inflammation and infection in your lungs, then that infection can travel and cause inflammation around these pleura. So in the case of pleurisy, we oftentimes look for some other cause. We look for something like pneumonia to be an underlying issue. Smoking and cigarettes can also cause pleurisy. That irritates the outer lining of the lungs. So every time someone breathes, it can cause a dull aching or a stabbing pain. The problem is, instead of letting those two pleura glide and slide like they're supposed to, they're inflamed, so they're rubbing past each other every time you take a breath in or out, or in fact, sometimes both. So pleurisy, the way it's treated, is oftentimes look for the root cause. If it's pneumonia, get rid of the pneumonia. If it's smoking, it may in fact involve stopping smoking. But whatever the root cause is, get rid of that, and the pleurisy will often follow suit and go away. Let me emphasize that we are talking about the lining on the outside of the lungs. This is not lining the inside where air is coming and going. This is literally between your lung and your thorax cavity wall. So every time your thorax expands to breathe in or relaxes, there may be a rub between those two pleural layers. This picture shows us a pneumothorax, and as the name implies, what is pneumo? Lung, yeah, air. So you kind of get the sense that there's air in the thorax or thoracic cavity. So normally the lungs look like mandarin oranges, I think. They look like a mandarin orange there. So obviously half of this space has been taken up by an air pocket. So what in the world could introduce an air pocket into the thoracic cavity space? Gunshot wound, stabbing wound, broken ribs. Yep. So anything that breaches the connection between the visceral and parietal pleura allows outside air to escape into your thoracic cavity, and it can fill up that space. The problem is this puts a lot of pressure on the existing lung, and what can occur is called atelectasis. That's a fancy word that simply means what? Lungs collapse, right? So we're going to learn today that in order for lungs to stay inflated, the pressure in there has to be negative to the outside world, meaning the pressure must be less than the outside world. Not like this, not equal to. Our last pleural issue is called pleural effusion. You know, when we covered the heart, we talked about pericardial effusion. This is the same thing, except it happens to affect the lungs instead of the heart. You know, back when we talked about the heart stuff, we also called it cardiac tamponade. This is the same concept, except that it's some kind of fluid built up around the lungs between those two pleural layers. It could be fluid. It could be serous fluid that builds up. It could be blood that builds up, pus from an infection. Lung cancers could cause this to build up in here. Lymphatic fluids could build up in this area. Chronic heart failure could push fluids back and cause accumulation here in this pleural space. Whatever the cause, we look at a lung tube or a chest tube to extract out that fluid, and that allows for it to drain, and most importantly, it allows for the existing lung to expand back into its original size. So that allows for respiration and gas exchange to continue as it should. All right, so another look at pleural effusion there. You can see it looks like a pocket of fluid gathered here around this lung. Let's talk about the disorders that affect the passageways. These are obstructive or restrictive in nature. And the issue is that obstructive disorders allow for difficulty exhaling, whereas restrictive disorders prevent full inhalation of air. So like I mentioned earlier, I keep the O straight. Obstructive disorders prevent the air from fully getting O out, okay? And then restrictive, we have difficulty inhaling in. Interesting to note that both types of diseases, both obstructive and restrictive, can lead to shortness of breath. You know, imagine that it's a kind of a panic situation if it's an initial thing that's beginning for a person. But some of these are chronic and long-term issues that a person learns to cope with. Just checking, does anybody need this slide? Anybody still using it? All good to go. Okay. So our first obstructive disorder is one called emphysema. And we all have heard that smoking and cigarette smoke can cause emphysema. So these people are known as pink puffers for a particular reason. It's because that they are not able to get the air out. Yeah. So I want you to notice how this guy is sitting. I want you to look at the chest cavity wall. It's not just a coincidence that he happens to be sitting with his arms on his knees and kind of bent over. That is classic position for an emphysema patient. It helps them to exhale the air out. Propping themselves up in that manner helps to push the air out of the lungs. Since he is having to work actively to exhale air, his muscles around the chest cavity begin to waste. So that's why you notice a rather thin chest cavity wall. He's having to force the air out of his lungs. We're going to learn today that exhalation is normally a passive process, meaning no ATP is required. If you have good elasticity for your lungs, once they stretch upon inhalation, the elasticity should recoil and automatically push the air out. But if you've got an obstructive disorder like this, you're physically having to work to get the air out of your lungs. So that kind of drives the pursed lips. It drives the muscle wasting around the chest cavity, and the way he's sitting makes it a little easier for him to push out that air. So I wanted to show you some pictures. This is what normal alveoli should look like. A lot of people say they look like grape clusters, but when they've been damaged, say through cigarette smoke, they've lost their elasticity and they've lost their surface area. So the combination of loss of elasticity and surface area means that we have to work to force the air out of the lungs. I'd like to show you another one. Here's another man, classic emphysema position. Notice the muscle wasting in the chest. He's sitting perched forward, and that's to help him push that air out of his lungs. So these patients are sometimes called pink puffers. I think you probably saw that in the previous picture. They're pink because they're not having trouble getting air in. The trouble is getting the air out of their lungs. So for that reason, they're not cyanotic. They're getting the oxygen. They just can't get rid of the CO2 as effectively as someone without this issue. You know, cigarette smoke is certainly a leading cause of emphysema. We know it also is a leading cause of lung cancers. So it's certainly a bad thing for us in many different ways. I know this picture is too small to read, but there's other stuff in cigarette smoke that can cause vasoconstriction. You know, things like nicotine in there is a vasoconstrictor. Other things affect other parts of our body, such as our digestive systems. So we oftentimes say smoking is a respiratory issue, when in fact it can affect other organ systems like digestive, for instance. Just for comparison, since we're on the topic of smoking, normal pink, healthy lungs, blackened and full of tar smokers' lungs, they do say that if a person stops smoking, that tar and stuff will eventually leave the lungs, but it takes about as many years as a person smoked to get that stuff back out of the lungs. So, you know, if that's not something that's convincing to not smoke. This is kind of a cool thing that was on the internet a few years ago. These are twins. Can you tell who is the smoker?
Right.
Yeah, notice how it affects the skin. It affects the collagen fibers. It promotes destruction of the collagen fibers, so they tend to sag a little more. And another set of twins. Can you tell who's the smoker this time?
right.
Yeah, they both look pretty warm, but the one on the right is Most classes can't agree. Most of them say, I don't know, they both look pretty like they've been smoking, but yeah, the one on the right's again a smoker.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah, maybe. So, you know, other things besides cigarette smoke can also be detrimental to our lung tissue. You know, welding is a good job, good paying job, good job security, but oh boy, is it bad for your lungs. You can get metal shards from what you're welding into the lung tissue, and your lung tissue can't get rid of it. So the black spots, they say in this picture, are actually pieces of metal shards. Yeah, so that's kind of scary. So if you work in a dusty environment, like construction, if you work in welding, certainly in a smoky environment, these things can all lead to loss of elasticity of that lung tissue, and that can cause emphysema. Let's see, asthma is another issue. You'll notice that we're going down the list there of obstructive disorders. So the issue is not necessarily getting the air in as much as it is getting the air back out. So what are some things that can lead to an asthma attack? Smoke, heat, allergens, yeah, even exercise, yeah. So cold weather, warm weather, allergens, dust, you know, exercise, anything that may trigger those linings to inflame can reduce the amount of air that's exiting the lungs. So I just wanted to mention, because it's something that we've talked about, if you have inflammation in the lining of the lungs, what type of hormone have we discussed that reduces inflammation? Histamine, that's one. Okay, that actually increases, so we take an antihistamine, right? What is another hormone that helps to reduce inflammation? Produced by the adrenal glands? Cortisol, yeah. So, in fact, one of the common treatments is a corticosteroid, which reduces inflammation. Is there any concern with long-term treatment of a corticosteroid like cortisol? Reduces your immunity. Good. What else does it do to you? Gain weight. Yeah, blood sugar increases, weight gain. Okay. Some other kinds of treatments are what we call beta agonists. And you might recall having learned about beta receptors back in Bio-210. These types of drugs actually really target in on those beta receptors and make them more effective. So they amplify the effects of drugs like epinephrine or adrenaline. So any concern there of taking an adrenaline or an epinephrine-based drug? Heart rate, yeah. Heart rate, blood pressure. So they're certainly not a drawback to taking these medications, but they may be helpful in treating someone with a case of asthma. Yeah, sure can. Anybody still need this one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anybody still need this one? Oh, good. Okay. Not that one, but that one. Okay. Okay. And then our third type of obstructive disorder is called bronchitis. This is often referred to as chronic bronchitis because it's a long-term condition. So we know that chronic diseases are not ones that tend to go away. They continue to worsen over time. So what do you think can lead to something like chronic bronchitis? smoke. Yep, once again, to cigarettes. Cigarette smoke exposure can lead to irritation and inflammation of that bronchial passageway. And yet again, we are looking at problems getting the air out. So technically, this is classified as an obstructive disorder. But the issue with bronchitis is it actually also reduces inflow of air. So it has an aspect of being a restrictive order as well, disorder as well. So that's why we call this particular type of issue a blue bloater issue. You'll notice this man's chest is a little more bloated and barrel-shaped than the last in the emphysema pictures, and that has to do with the inability to get adequate oxygen into the bloodstream. So hypoxia and cyanosis are more common when someone has bronchitis. We don't tend to see those issues when we see a patient with just emphysema. So let's talk through the heart failure aspect of this. If you have low oxygen levels in your bloodstream, what type of receptor picks up on that? Chemoreceptor, good. Who does the chemoreceptor report to? Cardiovascular center, good. What does the cardiovascular say we should do about hypoxia? Sympathetic nervous system, good. What happens to your heart rate?
Increases.
And your vessels?
It
constricts, so your blood pressure goes up. So as you continue down the path with this disease and you continue to be hypoxic, you see that we continue to have an increased heart rate and increased blood pressure. So eventually the heart says, I'm working as hard as I can. I'm pumping as fast as I can, and it gets bigger and flabbier, and it's trying to pump as much as it can, and then we have heart failure. So that's kind of how this particular disorder leads into heart failure. Well, eventually what we have is emphysema, we have chronic bronchitis, and we can also have asthma. The three of these form a perfect storm. The resulting disease is called COPD, or chronic obstructive, there's our word, right, obstructive pulmonary disease or disorder. So ultimately what happens is the respiratory system fails to move air in and out, and so we're unable to do gas exchange properly with this disease. Just checking to see if anybody needs this slide. Okay. So you may notice this is the same picture I used earlier. This is in fact the emphysema picture. You'll notice that the alveoli have lost their surface area, and because they can't do gas exchanges they once did, we're unable to get oxygen into the bloodstream and CO2 out of the bloodstream. So because we have a chemical bloodstream imbalance, you know, our blood gases are off kilter, now those chemoreceptors pick up on the information and we now affect heart rate and blood pressure. So that's how respiratory disorders ultimately can cause the downfall of the cardiovascular system as well. So can you tell which one of these pictures has lost surface area? Yeah, that one up here. So normal alveoli and then disease state up here on the top left. Great loss of surface area up there. The last two down there, restrictive disorders, I just wanted to mention to you, pulmonary fibrosis can come from, say, working in a dusty environment, working in an environment where there's debris in the air that you inhale. That can lead to scar tissue in the lungs. And then the final thing down there, obesity is also a restrictive disorder. Why would obesity cause problems getting air into the lungs? Yeah. Can't expand. Yeah, so there's too much tissue surrounding the lungs. We need the lungs to expand to bring the air in. All right, so that was just a quick tour. Do y'all have any questions on those respiratory disorders? Would you like help completing the pathway at the top of the page? Okay. So we're just going to follow the flow pathway of air here. We're going to do oxygen in first. We're on the top of page 72. We've got nares and nasal turbinates, and then we've got a blank for what?
Nasopharynx.
Good, nasopharynx. Nasopharynx leads to oropharynx. That takes us to our final pharynx, which is laryngopharynx. Good. That one's spelled L-A-R-Y-N-G-O. All right, from there we travel through the glottis. You can pick glottis or larynx as your next destination, whatever is easiest for you to remember. From that point, we travel through our next point, which is trachea. It branches into a set of bronchi that are termed
primary.
Good. I know some of you may have learned carina in there as part of your flow pathway. If you want to add that, you're welcome to. All right, so primary, secondary, tertiary bronchi. We then branch into the very smallest passageways known as
bronchioles.
Good. Okay, bronchioles branch into the alveolar air sacs. And now we're going to leave the airflow path and we're going to jump into blood flow. So from this point, we're following a molecule of oxygen into the pulmonary capillaries, pulmonary venules, pulmonary
veins.
Good. Pulmonary veins take you to what chamber?
Left atrium.
Left atrium. Good. From the left atrium, we travel to bicuspid valve, left ventricle, aortic semilunar valve, aorta, good. And this should be a familiar flow path. Arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules, veins, SVC, IVC, and then back to the
right atrium,
good. The CO2 pathway is really simple. If you know it one way, you automatically have the reverse pathway. Notice that we're going to start there with the pulmonary capillaries for CO2's exit, and from there we're just going to backtrack to the bronchioles, to the alveoli. And alveoli leads you to, from the alveoli to the bronchioles, I said that backwards. From bronchioles, we go to tertiary bronchi, and then where?
Secondary,
primary,
trachea.
Good, you got it all the way back, right? Okay, so I'll give you guys a moment just to do the reverse out. So when you get through doing that, why don't we take a break until around 2 o'clock, and then we're going to pick up with the midway point at page 72, their functions of the respiratory system. So I'll grab the lights for y'all. So we're getting ready to move into the physiology in this chapter. We're going to start on the midway point of page 72. And over the next several pages, we're going to talk about how the respiratory system does its job. We know the overarching function here is to exchange blood gases. And we're, of course, tied in with the cardiovascular system and transporting those blood gases out to the body. So we're going to focus on these four functions: pulmonary ventilation, external and internal respiration, and gas transport, as we cover this material today and on Wednesday. We, in fact, have already covered respiratory gas transport. That's the whole pathway of taking blood in arteries, arterioles, capillaries, doing a gas exchange, venules and veins, and back to our starting point. So we're going to really look at tying that in with how everything else works here for this system. What I left you on the bottom of page 72 is a summary. I'm going to actually detail that out as we work through the next three or four pages in this chapter, starting with breathing, which is also known as pulmonary ventilation. So let me take you over to the top of page 73. We'll talk there about breathing. Okay, and breathing is simply inhalation and exhalation, otherwise known as pulmonary ventilation. So I need to give you some background information on pressure and volume. This comes from a physics law, and if you haven't had physics, that's okay. This particular law is related to pressures and volumes. So what we're going to do is talk about the lungs as a volume space, and we're going to talk about the pressures related to the lungs and how they drive the air movement into and out of your lungs. So let's first talk about Boyle's Law. So I want you to notice that we're dealing with two variables, pressure and volume. When one variable increases, the other variable automatically decreases. We're going to say that these two variables are inversely proportional, meaning they have an opposite relationship with each other. So when pressure goes up, volume decreases. When pressure decreases, volume increases. I'm going to use a box to represent our thoracic cavity space. So if we're dealing with a large box or a large volume, what's going to happen to the air pressure inside that box? We've got a large volume. These are my air molecules. Decrease the pressure.
Yeah.
So when you've got a large volume or a large space, you've got plenty of room for those air molecules to rumble around. So pressure decreases in a large space. All of a sudden, you're going to make that space much smaller. So let's decrease the volume. Let's keep the same number of air molecules. Increase the pressure. Yes, yeah, so now we've got less room for them to rumble around. The pressure now increases in a smaller volume or a smaller thoracic cavity space. So we're going to hang on to this law for just a moment. We're going to go and talk about the lungs and how they're made. We'll put that over here. So we already know that each lung has a pleura. It has a visceral and a parietal layer. Where is the visceral layer found?
Touching.
Yeah. So just to make the point, I'm going to put a layer really close to your lungs here. That's going to be what we label as our visceral pleura. And just to make the point, I'm going to exaggerate the amount of room we've got between visceral and parietal pleura. So what is found between those two layers?
Serous fluid, yeah.
So these two layers, the visceral and the parietal layer, are literally stuck to each other. And if you've ever had a glass in the summertime that you've set on the table, that glass will sweat, and you'll come back 30 minutes or an hour later and try to pick up your glass, and if you lift straight off the table, that condensation has made a water seal to the table beneath.
So you may notice you give it a little bit of a pull and there's a suction there. So if you kind of bend your glass over to the side, you'll break that seal or suction and you can separate your glass from the table. That again is that issue of cohesion, water molecules and hydrogen bonds sticking together. That is what keeps your visceral and your parietal pleura stuck together. Very thin film of fluid here that keeps those two layers adhered to one another. There, in fact, is a pressure in that space, and we're going to call the pressure between the pleura the intrapleural pressure. I'm going to put this star down here. We're going to talk about that too. Vanessa, you?
Yeah.
Yeah, get ready to.
Okay.
That pressure must be less than intrapulmonary pressure, which I need to show you where that one's at. That's a different pressure altogether. Must be less than intrapulmonary pressure. Where is intrapulmonary pressure located?
Inside the lungs.
Inside the lungs, good. So we've taken care of two of our pressures. Intrapulmonary pressure is inside your lungs. Intrapleural pressure is in between your visceral and parietal pleura. And the catch is, it has to be less than your intrapulmonary pressure. If it's ever more than or equal to your intrapulmonary pressure, it squeezes your lungs and they collapse. We call that atelectasis, so we don't ever want that situation to arise. One final pressure is the one outside your body. It's number one on our list. Atmospheric pressure at sea level is around 760 millimeters mercury, or 1 atm. So we're just going to say that's what's outside your body. Okay, are you so far so good? Anything I can clear up before we move on? So let's talk about how we inhale. In order to inhale, we have to have a set of muscles involved in expanding or increasing the volume of our thoracic cavity. The two important sets are our diaphragm, which sits beneath our lungs, and our external intercostals, which is an outer layer of muscle between the ribs. When these muscles contract, what happens to your diaphragm first? Pushes down, yes. So it flattens out from its dome shape and it pushes down toward your stomach. When your external intercostals contract, they actually flare your rib cage out and make your rib cage wider. So if you put your hands on your rib cage and you take a deep breath of air, you're going to feel your rib cage move outward as you're trying to expand or increase the volume of your thoracic cavity. So we're going to make a really wide thoracic cavity. We're going to flatten out that diaphragm.
That's going to increase the volume in your thoracic cavity by contracting these muscles. And what happens to the intrapulmonary pressure?
Decreases.
It decreases, right. So intrapulmonary pressure decreases. All right, so what is 760? Yeah, outside atmospheric pressure. If you're going to inhale, you have to be lower than 760. So to inhale, your intrapulmonary pressure must be something like 759, 758, because what we're setting up here is a pressure gradient. We know that air flows from high pressure to low pressure, and it's going to follow a gradient from outside your body to inside your lungs. So if atmospheric pressure is 760, let's just say that we're looking at 759 for your intrapulmonary pressure. And if you're looking at 759 for your intrapulmonary pressure, what must your intrapleural pressure be?
Less than.
Yeah, so at least 758, 757. Let's just go with 755, that way we're clear.
Can
okay.
You push in that?
Yes, you can. I'm probably still in the way. Good. So to repeat, to inhale air, your diaphragm and intercostal muscles contract. When your diaphragm contracts, it flattens and pushes down toward your stomach. If you've ever been in a class where singing is involved, or perhaps playing a musical instrument, or even speech class, what do they tell you to breathe from?
Diaphragm.
Yeah, because if you're breathing from up at the top of your lungs, you're not getting a full breath of air. So push down that diaphragm. Flare out that rib cage, let those external intercostals contract, and that increases the volume in your thoracic cavity. Automatically, we're going to decrease our intrapulmonary pressure less than atmospheric pressure. We're going to stay at 759, and to keep our lungs inflated, that intrapleural pressure is going to be even lower at about 755. So we've set up a pressure gradient. High pressure is outside your body, low pressure inside your lungs. This allows for air to be sucked into your lungs along a pressure gradient. Okay, that's all it is. Muscles contract, volume increases, pressure decreases, air flows in. It is that simple. Okay. So in order to exhale, we're going to have to let those muscles relax. So our diaphragm returns to a dome-shaped position, and our external intercostals relax back to their normal position. So what has happened to the space or volume inside your thoracic cavity? Volume has decreased. Pressure will increase, yeah. We're talking about intrapulmonary pressure. And we're going to say now that it is up to 761. If the atmospheric pressure outside your body is still 760, we've now set up our pressure gradient. So which way does air now flow? Flows out, yeah, from high pressure 761. To low pressure 760, air inside your lungs is forced out along a pressure gradient. All right, but to maintain pressure inside your lungs and to keep them from deflating, that intrapleural pressure between the two membranes has to be less than intrapulmonary pressure. So we're going to pick something like 758. And see, that's still low enough that it's less than your intrapulmonary pressure. They'll stay inflated. So to inhale and contract muscles, you require ATP and muscles that are healthy. To exhale, it is simply a passive process, meaning there is no ATP involved in passive breathing. So if you want to take a breath of air in, you actually have to use ATP to work to get the air to come in. When you relax, that's all it is muscles returning to their relaxed state. However, if you climb the stairs in this building, I know all of us have probably done that at some point, when you get near the top stairs, you start to feel yourself really working to get the air out. If you're forcing the air out, you actually engage other accessory breathing muscles, such as your trapezius, your sternocleidomastoid, even your internal intercostals, and they will actively contract to help you force air out if you're exercising. But you know, all of you are sitting here at a resting state right now, and it's really not necessary for your accessory exhalation muscles to work, because there's no point in helping you to force air out right now. Okay, so I brought the bell jar to class. I'd like you to see how this works. This is a pretty cool little contraption. All we have is just a jar with a hole at the top. You can see that we've got a couple of balloons attached to a pipe at the top. I'm going to seal that hole up. At the bottom, we have something like a glove. This is the same stuff that makes rubber gloves. And right now, if you take a look, both of those lungs look like they're fairly deflated. In fact, if we take and push up, you'll notice they deflate even further. So this is acting as which muscle on the bottom? Diaphragm, good. What is the tube on top acting like?
Trachea,
good. So you can see when we push up on the diaphragm, those balloons completely deflate. And then let me get a grip here. There we go. So when you pull down, what happens to those lungs? Inflate. So just like when your diaphragm pushes down, you're going to see a contraction, increasing the volume, decreasing the pressure, air sucks in. And then when you return that diaphragm back up to its normal position, you can see those balloons or lungs deflate. So pretty cool little contraption, just works on the movement of this diaphragm at the very bottom. So pretty neat, pretty easy thing to construct to illustrate pressure and volume changes and Boyle's law there. How about questions on Boyle's law? Questions on pulmonary ventilation, breathing? At the bottom of the page, you've got three things that influence respiration or breathing, and you'll notice airway resistance is one of them. Okay, we've got alveolar surface tension as another, and lung compliance. So this should sound a little bit familiar. Back when we talked about blood flow, resistance was peripheral resistance, and that was anything that impeded the flow of blood through the vessels. Here, if you have a change in the diameter of your passageways, that too can impede airflow into or out of your lungs. How can we reduce number two, that surface tension? What oily secretion reduces surface tension? Yes, surfactant. So as long as that's in place, we keep those lung tissues from sticking together. And then finally, compliance is the name for the ability to stretch and retract back into its normal position. Do you want to take a picture of the bell jar? That stuff, okay. I'll get this out of the way. Okay. Moving on to a different topic, but somewhat related, is page 74. This should feel very familiar. We've been here, done this before. We've talked about your cardiovascular center in your medulla oblongata. Now we're going to talk about your respiratory center in your medulla. And this time, the respiratory center actually controls the rate of your respiration. There is no pacemaker in the lungs like there is for the heart. So this respiratory center is the pacemaker, you might say, of respiration. It sets the pace and controls how fast your breathing rate is. I want you to notice there is a phrenic nerve that's involved in telling your lungs, you know, in your thoracic cavity what to do. The phrenic nerve is actually in your cervical plexus. It is found on both sides of your neck. It travels through your neck and into your thoracic cavity, where it innervates your external intercostal muscles and your diaphragm. Upon firing and releasing acetylcholine, what happens to your diaphragm and intercostals? Contract, yeah. So they're going to contract when that phrenic nerve tells them to do so. So keep in mind, we're not going to really talk about the vagus nerve here. This time, our focus is on a different nerve called the phrenic nerve. It is not a cranial nerve. It's simply a branch of the cervical nerve plexus that's in your neck that's made up of several cervical spinal nerves. So the inspiratory center of your respiratory center kind of serves as your pacemaker. It sets the rate for the breathing rate. And you'll notice if you read along there with me, it causes contraction of the diaphragm and intercostal muscles by way of the phrenic nerve. There's your blank. So when your phrenic nerve tells your diaphragm and intercostal muscles to contract, what happens to the volume in your thoracic cavity? Increases, and your pressure decreases. Good. Specifically, we're talking about the intrapulmonary pressure that's found where? Inside your lungs. Good. The next bullet point says after 2 seconds of a nerve impulse, that phrenic nerve finally stops sending a message. And by that time, we've accomplished increasing the volume in your thoracic cavity, and we should have air starting to flow in. So your phrenic nerve stops firing, and we sit dormant for about 3 seconds. During this time, gas exchange is occurring, and then finally, your muscles begin to relax, forcing the air out of your lungs. So it's a timing mechanism. It's 2 seconds with the phrenic nerve on, about 3 seconds with the phrenic nerve turned off. This gives you a few seconds to breathe in, do gas exchange, and then let the air flow back out. If you were to count your own respiration rate, you're going to find that you're breathing around 12 to 18 or 12 to 15 breaths per minute. The younger you are, like a child, the faster your respiration rate's going to be. Little kids and babies have very fast respiration rates. Okay, so if you, any of you in the nursing program currently, are they telling you guys 12 to 18 right now? Okay, so the textbook that we use says 12 to 15, but I'll take 12 to 18 since I know that's what they're teaching in nursing is an adult normal respiration rate. So what this is called eupnea. This means that we're looking at a normal rate of around 12 to 15 or 12 to 18 respirations per minute.
Brooke.
Just to keep it simple, no, 12 to 18 is okay. And if I give you a fast rate, I'll give you something like 25, so we're free and clear of that, okay. That weirdness there. The only time you need your expiratory neurons is when you need a forced expiration. So a great example of this is climbing the stairs in this building. If you need help pushing the air out of your lungs, we turn on expiratory neurons. They fire and they encourage accessory muscles like trapezius, sternocleidomastoid, internal intercostals to help you force the air out. But under normal situations, we don't need those expiratory neurons or those accessory exhalation muscles. So catch the term there. Eupnea is normal respiration. How about dyspnea? What is that? Difficult breathing, right? So we often call that shortness of breath. We have all heard, I'm sure, of apnea, which means
not breathing.
So we've heard of sleep apnea and things like that. The next term you'll notice is called hyperpnea, and this is forceful breathing. We can still have a normal respiration rate, but we can do so forcefully. So if you pretend that you're a monster or whatever, and you go, you can still do it 12 times a minute, right? So you're still within a eupnea range, but I've just added forceful breathing on top of it. So eupnea is a normal rate. Hyperpnea simply means that we're forcefully breathing. okay? Now, when you change the actual respiration rate, we're doing what's called hyperventilation or hypoventilation. That actually gets you slower than 12 breaths per minute, and since we're going to use 18, that'll get you faster than 18 breaths per minute. Are you so far so good with our terms? I'm going to erase this. Does anyone need a picture before I erase? Good to go. Okay. Okay, before we get into all this stuff about respiration rates, what I'd like to do is do a pH review for you. We know the pH scale is based on hydrogen ion concentration. That's what the H in pH stands for. And we also know that normal blood pH is between what and what?
7.35.
Good, 7.35, whoops, 7.45. Okay, so we know that pH is based on hydrogen ion concentration. I want to emphasize that because if I accumulate hydrogen ions, we are heading below 7.35 into what territory?
Acidosis.
Good. This can serve as a point of confusion because when you increase hydrogens, you actually decrease pH, right? Okay, so I want to make sure we're not confused there. Increasing hydrogens means that you can actually decrease pH. We know that if we lose hydrogen ions, or in another way to put it, gain hydroxide ions, that our blood pH begins to increase above 7.45. We can handle about 8.0 and the top end. We can handle about down to 6.8. Beyond those numbers, we're looking at death. So we don't have a very wide range there that we can live with in terms of pH. So alkalosis heads above 7.45. Acidosis is what handles the situation below 7.35. Ideally, we're going to try to stay within that 7.35 to 7.45 range. I'm hoping this is all just a review or maybe some clarification for you. Any questions on this stuff? On your worksheet is an equation. I want to talk to you about that equation. And I'm going to write it up here so we can work through it. So we all have heard that oxygen is this life-giving gas and we're going to die without enough oxygen, right? Okay, so granted oxygen is important, but CO2 is actually the one behind the scenes that controls your blood pH, not oxygen. Oxygen does not influence your blood pH like CO2 does. CO2 has a direct influence over your blood pH, and yeah, you can die with CO2 levels to be out of whack, you can see here as well. We think of CO2 as a waste product. It comes from the metabolism of oxygen and glucose into ATP. So we carry a certain amount in our bloodstream at all times. In excess, we end up having a poisoning effect for our cells. So this is kind of a waste product of metabolism. Cells all over
your body are making carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide follows a pressure gradient from high pressure to low pressure. We move the carbon dioxide into your capillaries by diffusion, and in your capillaries, it will actually form something called bicarbonate ions when it dissolves in your blood's plasma. Thinking back, what is your blood plasma primarily made of? Water. Yeah, there you go. So that water is the water in your blood plasma. When carbon dioxide and water combine together in your blood's plasma, they form this acid called carbonic acid. Carbonic acid is not very stable, so it quickly breaks apart or dissociates into these products here, hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions. Okay, so when you break apart carbonic acid, you get two things. You get hydrogen ions, which influence our blood pH. And you get bicarbonate ions, HCO3. It's an anion. I'll go ahead and tell you that is the most common method for transport of carbon dioxide in the bloodstream. Down here or up here? In blood. So hydrogens and bicarbonates are transported in the bloodstream. So let me repeat. Our cells make CO2. CO2 is a waste product. Carbon dioxide diffuses into our capillaries. Now we're in the bloodstream. Blood, of course, contains a lot of water, and that water combines with carbon dioxide to make an acid. We know that acids give away hydrogen ions. There's the hydrogen ion that it gives away. When you give away a hydrogen ion, you're left with HCO3. It's actually a bicarbonate ion. And that's how we transport carbon dioxide. You can actually see that there's a CO2 embedded within that particular molecule. So when you get back to the lungs, we can transform this reaction in the opposite direction and exhale out our CO2 as a gas. So I don't want you to think that CO2 is riding in your bloodstream like carbonated Coke. You know, you don't have bubbles of gas in your blood. You actually have carbon dioxide traveling as this bicarbonate, rather than being a carbonated soda that's full of air bubbles. That's, of course, not what we do with carbon dioxide. So the issue is that CO2 has a direct influence on your blood pH. The more CO2 you build up, the more hydrogen ions you have. The less CO2 you have, the less hydrogen ions you have. Okay? Let's think about that again. The more CO2 you have, the more hydrogens. And which way does your pH go? Down, acid, yeah. So the more CO2 you put in your bloodstream, the more hydrogens you have in your bloodstream, the more acidic your blood becomes. Now the less CO2 you've got, the less hydrogens you'll build up in your bloodstream, and the more alkaline your blood becomes.
So let me emphasize, we're not breathing yet. We're just talking about cause and effect. This is the effect that CO2 has on the blood pH. The more CO2 you've got, the more acidic your blood becomes. The less CO2 you've got, the more alkaline your blood becomes. That's all we're doing is a statement of cause and effect. We haven't tied in this breathing rate stuff yet, okay? Anything I can clear up on this before we take the next step? Have I lost you completely with chemistry? I hope not.
You said there's more carbon dioxide, more acidic.
More acidic. The less CO2, the more alkaline. If it helps you to think of it this way, think about carbonated drinks. They're acidic. You know, so the carbon dioxide presence you might think of as having an acidifying nature to it. So yeah, CO2 acidifies the blood pH. Okay, so let's take a look at these. Now we're going to talk about respiration rate changes. So first off, what is hyperventilation? Breathing faster. Yeah, so we're talking about a respiration rate faster than 18 breaths per minute. And so let's say that you've got somebody breathing 25 breaths per minute. Okay, maybe they won one of those $400 million lotteries that come along every so often. I'd be hyperventilating, right? So if you start breathing faster than normal, then what you're going to do is you're going to exhale off too much of your CO2. So when you have too little CO2, what happens to your hydrogen ion concentration? It goes down. What happens to your blood pH? It goes up, yeah. So the faster you breathe, hypocapnia means not enough CO2, you send yourself into something called respiratory alkalosis. That's because your respiratory system is at fault for causing the blood pH imbalance. And the faster you breathe, the more oxygen you get. That's a separate issue entirely, but it's called hyperoxia. So why do they hand somebody who's hyperventilating a paper bag and say, breathe? Give them more CO2, right? Because if you have too little CO2, breathe in your own exhaust. How does that help your blood pH? Lowers it, yeah. So by breathing so fast, you raise your pH, and now this starts to put the CO2 back in and put your pH back where it needs to be.
What did you say hyperoxia was?
Hyperoxia is too much oxygen. It's excess, yeah. Did y'all get all your blanks there? It's too little hydrogen ions. Okay. Let's flip it in the other direction. Let's talk about what hypoventilation will do to your blood pH. Hypoventilation means you're breathing slower than around 12 breaths per minute. In that case, you're going to be hanging on to a lot of your CO2, and we have a condition called hypercapnia, meaning excess CO2. Well, let's go back to our chart. The more CO2 you keep, the more hydrogen ions you make, and where does your blood pH go?
Down.
Goes down, yes. So you're now heading into acidosis territory. We're going to specify and call it respiratory acidosis. We don't want to confuse someone into thinking that another system is causing this issue. The slower you breathe, the least amount of oxygen you're going to get into your body. So hypoxia means we're losing the amount of O2 that we're bringing in. Okay, so if you choose to breathe faster or slower, if your brain overrides control of your respiratory center, these are the kinds of chemistry changes we expect to see in your bloodstream. So we expect to see a shift in your blood pH. All right, so are you with me so far? Okay. Do you feel pretty comfortable with what we've covered so far? Okay. What I'm going to do is take you over to the next page. We're going to talk about regulation of respiration. This is a big old rerun, thankfully. Okay, so back when we talked about all the blood pressure and heart rate stuff, we mentioned there were chemoreceptors sitting in your aortic arch and common carotid arteries. Rerun, same thing again. These same chemoreceptors are picking up on oxygen levels, CO2 levels, hydrogen ion levels. It is the same issue as what we had before. The same three are grouped together as being encouraging faster respiration, faster heart rate, and increased blood pressure. And the same three issues will also cause a decrease. So we're looking at the same grouping as what we had before. Once your brain gets the input of this information from a chemoreceptor, then the respiratory center decides whether or not we should increase respiration or decrease respiration to fix the problem. So, you know, if we've got too much CO2 and our pH is too low, then how can we modify our respiration rate to fix this issue? If you've got too much CO2 and your blood pH is too acidic, should you breathe faster or slower? Yeah, breathe faster, get rid of more of the CO2. If you don't have enough CO2 and your blood pH is alkaline, breathe slower. Yeah, hang on to that CO2. So that's what we're going to do, is look at these chemical inputs as being a driver behind whether we should respire faster or slower. So I'm not going to read the chart to you. We've been there, done that. I think that you'll learn this by doing it kind of through a practice problem scenario. So if you'll flip over to page 76 with me, you can use your chart on page 75 to answer those 10 questions on page 76. So I'm going to cut you guys loose. We'll try to do answers at about 5 minutes of three, and hopefully we'll have a chance to work through those by that point. If you need help, holler at me. Okay, that first problem there talks about metabolic acidosis, and acid is the problem. That's our stimulus. Excess hydrogen ions create acidosis. Okay, so that's 1A. In response to having too many hydrogen ions, what does the respiratory center say we should do? Good. Increase phrenic nerve stimulation. And when you do that, you tell your diaphragm and intercostals to breathe faster. Okay, so 1C says, how does the respiration rate change? We're going to hyperventilate, right? So increase respiration. And the fancy name for that is hyperventilate. Did you get number one done correctly?
Yes.
Okay. Any questions on that one? Number two says, too many antacids have caused Miss M to have too few hydrogen ions in her blood. All right. The stimulus is what pH issue?
Alkalosis,
right. Okay. So then 2B says, how does the respiratory center respond or compensate?
Decrease
respiration, right. And so how does that help you? What are you keeping more of?
CO2,
and they create hydrogens, yeah. So for letter 2C, the respiration rate will cause blood pH to return to normal by retaining more CO2 and by retaining more hydrogen ions. Okay, so 2C, the respiration rate change helps you to return to normal pH by helping you keep more CO2 and more hydrogen ions. That would work.
Yeah, the same thing.
Same thing. It's just two different ways to say the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're good. All right, how about questions for number two? All right, number three, we're looking at a high elevation in hypoxia. The stimulus this time is low oxygen, which is hypoxia. How does the respiratory center respond to this situation? Good. Increased stimulation to the phrenic nerve. And then so letter C, how does this respiration rate change help your oxygen levels? Increase more O2 into your system, and that gets you back into a normal oxygen range. CO2 doesn't look to be an issue here, or pH. It seems to be it's just an oxygen issue. So CO2 and pH go hand in hand, and oxygen is kind of off by itself. It's not a direct influence over pH. Yet for number 3C, the respiration rate change helps you get more oxygen into your bloodstream. Yep, increases O2. So far, so good. Any questions so far? Okay. Number 4 there, if you see someone breathing quickly, they must be compensating for what type of pH imbalance? Acidosis, yeah. And by breathing fast, what are they getting rid of? CO2, exactly. For number 5, aspirin overdose can cause an overstimulation of the respiratory center. Overstimulation means you're probably going to hyperventilate. What pH problem does this create? Alkalosis, yeah. So 5A, this creates alkalosis. Why? Yeah, you're breathing too fast and removing too much of your CO2. So that sends you into an alkalosis scenario. Have you worked on numbers 6 through 10 yet? Some of you have not. Why don't I let you finish those, and we'll start class by doing the answers for 6 through 10. That way you get a chance to work a little more on these.